My name is Greg Felton. I'm in Vancouver, Canada. I have been a journalist for I was a journalist for quite a few years. I moved to teaching English, which is how I make my money during the day. But I've also never lost my love for investigative journalism. I've written three books, two of which have to do with the Middle East and Palestine and the corrupting influence of the Israel lobby on the United States. The second one is a compendium of essays about the Middle East, media censorship, and some satires that I've written. This is my third book, the one on COVID-2, and I'm probably going to do some follow-up work on it as well.
So what was it first about this story? Obviously, it's probably the biggest story of the decade, if not the century, this massive pandemic or plandemic, depending on how you're looking at it. But what was it that made you think that it was going to benefit from having a real investigative eye on it?
What made me question this is that is what makes me question a lot of things is that when people hold a strong view of something and they viciously go after people who criticize them, then I have to think something is wrong with the original theory. I was trying to think about this before our talk today about what got me interested in this. And I started to wondering about all this mask wearing and whether it was really necessary. Then I started to look at the virus itself. I followed up some news articles that I had, and I guess it was rather just fortuitous that I came upon a number of sites that pointed out certain inconsistencies in the official version of saying that the SARS-CoV-2 virus had its origin in nature. And because of that, I started to look into it more deeply. And the more I looked, the more I realized there was a massive cover-up of human manipulation of the 2003-2004 SARS virus. And the more I dug into it, the more I realized that we were being sold a bill of goods. Now, it's hard to state categorically anything about this because so much information is not being divulged. But it can be stated, I think, with virtual certainty, with asymptotic certainty, that the official narrative of the SARS-CoV-2 virus coming from bats in Wuhan or some other place in China is not defensible. And if it's not defensible and contrary theories are attacked, then there has to be a political motive for censoring criticism. And that's what got me interested in this.
Okay, well, look, first of all, let's start with that because that's quite contentious. It's supposed to have either come from pangolins or bats and migrated into humans actually over in China. So what evidence have you got that that's not the case? It's not easy to disprove a theory like that.
Well, it's not easy for the layman, but if you look at the nature of the virus itself and its composition, you know that it could not possibly happen. First of all, a virus has the strongest affinity for its host. And one of the sort of mantras that the zoonotic or natural origin theory people say is that bats are the natural reservoir of coronaviruses. Well, yes, that's true. But if that were the case, then SARS-CoV-2 would have a natural, the highest affinity for bats, but it doesn't. It has the highest affinity for human beings. So right away, there's a problem with the zoonotic theory. The pangolin argument is also quite corrupt because there's absolutely no evidence that this was even relevant. In fact, a lot of the writing about the pangolin virus, comes from one source, and that source gets recycled over and over again by other researchers that simply repeat the same information under their own name. As a matter of fact, one of the great corruptions I found about the SARS-CoV-2 virus is the active censorship of contrary information in the scientific literature. A lot of publications write about the SARS virus, and they don't really add any new information. It's a very incestuous community. And I have to credit Dr. Aileen Chan, who did a lot of work to trace the origin of articles in the scientific literature and realize that they were coming from a common source. So this really tells me there is something really strange
what you're saying is that if you're tracing back these references, because all of these papers come with loads of, you know, very detailed references, that you may find reference to a paper, but that paper is then referencing back to the same original paper. So it's not actually fresh information.
That's exactly right. A lot of it is just circular. And it's really kind of frustrating because you have the scientific community, which you would think would be the place we would go to for informed criticism, informed analysis. But they're doing more to cover up the lab origin of SARS-CoV-2 than probably anybody. And so if you can't trust places like Lancet or Nature, then who can you trust?
Right at the very beginning of all of this, back in the first week in February, we quoted Zero Hedge on our radio show in Bristol before we were taken off the air. Mm-hmm. And then we said that there had been this report from the Virology Institute. I believe it was New Delhi University, and had a good old look at it and said that they believed it was unlikely that the spike proteins on this SARS-CoV-2 would occur in nature. So they were being, you know, very professional in academic terms. They weren't saying this was made in a lab. They were hinting that it was most likely that that was what the origin of it was. So I wonder, what have you turned up that also suggests that this may be lab made? Because, I mean, this is obviously a very important aspect which hasn't really been addressed by the mainstream media. I was even on the radio and I was over in New Zealand, and the presenter said, well, that maybe this is a question, Tony, for something once this pandemic has finished. But there's definitely some evidence around, including I believe it was Richard Dearlove, former director general of MI6, I think it was around about August time, he popped up and also said that it could be bioengineered in some way. But this is a massive, massive question. And I think, you know, for me, I smell a rat when such important questions are simply not being addressed. Anyway, so what did you make of, you know, what evidence did you put together and find that pointed you towards it being something which wasn't naturally occurring, other than what you've already told us?
This is chapter two of my book, and it's actually one of the hardest chapters to read because it's very detailed and it gets into the science of virology and epidemiology. Also, chapter three goes into the specifics of the Indian paper that you just mentioned. And in fact, I interviewed the doctors, the researchers who wrote the paper, because they couldn't get the time of day from anybody in the mainstream media. We'll come back to that in 1 second. But what told me that they were correct, they argued that the SARS-CoV-2 virus has some genetic code spliced from HIV to make it really infectious. Now, I found that a little strange initially when I heard about HIV, but they're not alone. They did some seriously accurate scientific analysis of the genome of SARS-CoV-2, and they found five separate sequences of genetic material that could only be found, four sequences that are identical to HIV. Now, if you find one, that's maybe a coincidence. As they told me, two is kind of rare. If you find three, that's kind of hitting the limits of probability. And four is, well, this clearly has to come from HIV. Now,
well, look, sorry to interrupt you, but you were saying that HIV somehow makes it more infectious. Surely HIV is actually not very infectious. You have to catch it directly from someone else's blood.
Well, that may be true, but there's one part of the HIV splice that has a certain number of amino acids. Now, there are 20 amino acids in our body, some of them necessary, some of them not. Essential, some are not essential, but one of them had one that had proline, arginine, arginine, and alanine in the sequence, and that connected up to another arginine. Now, the fact that you had with that attachment, you had this sequence, arginine, arginine, alanine, arginine. And this is a sign that marks it as what's called a furin cleavage site. Now, this might get a little technical, so I'll try to be as quick as I can. Furin is an enzyme that is widely dispersed throughout the human body. It's integral for cleaving or cutting proteins after they're made so that they can be primed or made to work. It's like unwrapping the package off an action figure you buy at a novelty store. You've got to make it work. You've got to take the wrapping off. So cutting a protein essentially activates it. But furin recognizes a site on some genome that says RRAR. And that's a furin cleavage site. So boom, we'll cut that. However, if the virus has that cleavage site, then the furin recognizes it immediately. And that's what starts the virus infecting the body. And when it's carried into the cell through endocytosis, that makes it a very infectious disease. Now, furin is more widely dispersed throughout the body than other kinds of enzymes like cathepsin or trypsin. So when the SARS-CoV-2 virus latches onto the ACE2 receptor, the angiotensin-converting enzyme 2 receptor, it becomes more virulent because it's more easily cleaved to make it more active. And this is one of the splices that came from HIV. So clearly, the furin cleavage site, as all of my research has pointed out, and which is widely known, does not exist in SARS. The only coronavirus that has a furin cleavage site naturally is MERS. And that's a different subfamily from SARS. And nobody is arguing that MERS is the origin of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So that particular sequence of PRRAR had to have come from outside the disease itself. And this is one of the signs that points to lab manipulation. And in fact, if you go back to 2006, there had been copious manipulations of the SARS virus. Like, this is not rocket science. This is a technique that has been tried and done many times before. So the idea... So
the question has to be, surely, if this technique has been used before, who's been using this technique? Because it may be that they're responsible for this COVID.
Well, that's entirely possible. But the question is, you need to ask yourself, is why they would bother. And this is where we get into a sort of an ethical black hole called gain-of-function research. Now, this is something that's been going on for a better part of 20 years, where you have scientists taking infectious viruses and juicing them to make them even more infectious and more lethal. Now, that's counterintuitive to what a doctor or a researcher should do. But the standard defense for this is that, well, this is what we use to ensure that we can create a virus in case we ever have a pandemic, which is a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like telling a gang of arsonists and pyromaniacs, take all these flamethrowers, incendiary devices and whatnot, and go set fire to a city just so we can ensure that our fire department is strong enough to put it out. So the gain-of-function research rationale is essentially a non-starter, both ethically and scientifically. And there is a considerable debate now about whether such a scientific practice ought to continue. And in fact, Barack Obama, when he was president in October 2014, put a moratorium on all gain-of-function research because of a fear there would be a lab leak. The Centers for Disease Control had a leak of 2 viruses, and there was a serious uproar over the use of H5N1 gain-of-function research at the University of Madison, Wisconsin. So the American government realized that this is something that we do not want to have on American soil. This is 2014. 2015, out of nowhere, miraculously, the Wuhan Institute of Virology begins gain-of-function research. And it's funded by National Institutes of Health, which gave money to Echo Health Alliance. And that is the money bags that was paying for this research, which is against the spirit, if not the law, letter of the law, of Obama's moratorium. So that's how we ended up with this. We had doctors doing work that they should not have been doing according to a presidential directive.
So are you saying they basically farmed it out abroad?
Yep, that's exactly what they did.
But Wuhan, I mean, surely it can't just be simple coincidence.
No, it's not coincidence. Wuhan had been wanting a level 4 lab for quite some time. By the way, laboratories come in four grades, 1, 2, 3, and 4. The highest one, biosafety level 4, is what's used when you're dealing with the most dangerous, most toxic, most virulent diseases. And people inside these laboratories have to wear portable oxygen with them. They're living in some sort of hermetically sealed sub-environment. At least that's what it's supposed to be. Although there have been cases where these moon suits have been torn, ripped, and there have been possible transmissions of virus to these people. I mean, it's not perfectly safe, but it's very safe. At any rate, this is what Wuhan wanted. And there was a lab in Lyon, France, that was had formed a partnership, at least supposed to be a partnership with France, with China, to build the Wuhan laboratory, the BSL-4 lab in Wuhan. It turns out, however, that the Chinese sort of froze the French out as soon as they could, and the French didn't really benefit much from any sort of joint work ventures that they had expected to participate in. And what's kind of interesting is that the BSL-4 lab in Wuhan was supposed to be picking up where some of the BSL-3 labs were going to stop doing. Now, these are some mobile P3, what are called P3 or BSL-3 labs, and they were working on biological warfare. Term warfare experts were fearing that China might use this new lab to create biological weapons. And, you know, China didn't tell the French what was going to happen with these former BSL-3 labs, these portable labs. So there was some concern among the French, but by this time there was very little they could do about it. It was almost a done deal.
Aren't they outlawed, Greg? I mean, surely biological labs, particularly for any kind of military use, are outlawed now.
Well, certainly that's the case in the United States. Since 1969, it's formally any sort of offensive biological weapons program or any germ warfare program. Nevertheless, Francis Boyle, who wrote the Biological and Weapons Act, I have to get the actual name. It's a bit of a mouthful. Biological Warfare in 89. And it was passed unanimously by Congress under George H.W. Bush's presidency. And this is 20 years after they've formally said, we're not going to do biological germ warfare anymore. So the United States has legislation for biological weapons. Nevertheless, gain-of-function research, which I spoke about earlier, essentially falls into the same category. You're creating a germ, a biological entity that has harmful implications. So yes, you're probably quite right. It is illegal. But due to the sleight of hand and linguistic chicanery that goes with governments, there are ways around it. And I cannot say whether China is a signatory to the Biological Weapons Act or whether it sees that what it does is consistent with the germ warfare, whether it's some other kind of operation. One of the most offensive things I saw when I was doing my research was that this is called life science research. I mean, that's a horrible euphemism.
Now, yeah, for something that's killing people.
Right. Now, what's interesting also is that in the United States, there is an understanding of what is called dual-use technology. Now, dual-use means both civilian and military. Dual-use is a buzzword. It's kind of like it hides the fact that we're kind of making, you know, something harmful to kill the enemies of the United States, which are always assumed to be terrorists, which is such an elastic word that it has lost all meaning. So there are documents. One of them goes by the name of the Tools for the Identification, Assessment, Management, and Responsible Communication of Dual-Use Research of Concern. Now, that's a horrible mouthful of nonsense. That essentially it says that, yes, we're going to have dual-use that is a military civilian use of biological entities. But we're going to be very careful how we use it. And this is an open secret. I mean, this is not really anything that should come as any surprise to anybody. I mean, it doesn't take much to go on the internet and look at biosecurity, dual use. And there's a wealth of information out there. This is public domain information.
Does it matter whether or not COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2 is genetically engineered or natural? I mean, at the end of the day, it's having the same sort of effect as something which had mutated naturally.
I would say yes. And Francis Boyle makes this point, as well as Birger Sørensen, the Norwegian researcher. It's important to know the etiology of the virus, to know what kind of vaccine could be effective. But without a knowledge of what this disease is, without a proper history, then essentially the vaccine's like random stabs in the dark. If I'm a doctor and I'm treating a patient, and he presents with certain, intestinal or neurological symptoms, I need to know everything so I can prescribe the right remedy. Well, the same is true of a vaccine for a virus. You don't throw things at it and hope it'll work. And what's even more dangerous in this case, and this is something that Sørensen also said, needing to have a proper history, is that a vaccine can also cause something called antibody-dependent enhancement, which in plain English means the vaccine might help you get over the virus, but should you get it again, you'll get it even worse and maybe die from it. So in many respects, and this has been found to be the case with SARS and MERS, this has been proven. So if we understand that SARS-CoV-2 is a genetically modified version of SARS, and SARS has antibody-dependent enhancement side effects, well, maybe we should be a little bit more careful about how fast we're rushing these things through the approval process. I mean, I've seen no information to tell me that the ADE has been successfully dealt with and removed as a concern. All I'm seeing are people almost deterministically clamoring for a vaccine for its own sake, not really taking time to understand whether the vaccine is actually in anybody's best interest.
Yeah, there's also the problem of what we call the revolving door, isn't there? That quite a lot of the people who are involved, here in the UK with the medicines regulator authority, are people from industry, that is to say the pharmaceutical industry, and also that are involved in projects funded by people like the Gates Foundation, the Wellcome Foundation. So they're very close to the industry itself. One does wonder whether the industry feels that it has now control of the UK regulator.
Well, that's a legitimate concern. And this is also the concern in the United States, because a Pfizer executive is high up the American government approving these vaccines. I mean, the incestuous relationship between big business and the government, this is not news at all. This has been going on for ages. And it's something that is not adequately exposed to the public, which is being treated like a multifaceted guinea pig. The entire world population is trusting that the people coming up with these vaccines know what they're doing, and that it's in the best interests of humanity to take them. Yet there's no evidence that proper safety protocols are being followed. This is a horrible place to be in, because people feel they're damned if they take the vaccine and damned if they don't. And I'll tell you how bad this is. I mean, how the public is being deliberately gaslighted by the media. Forbes magazine came out with a story that was an interview with Sørensen. And the Sørensen interview came out on June the 7th of this year. Now, the original headline said, Norway scientist claims report proves coronavirus was lab-made. Wow, that's pretty good for Forbes magazine, which is a pretty much a big business publication. Well, what's kind of weird about this is that on the same day, with the same timestamp, Forbes overwrote the same article and called into question the very claims that Sorensen was making without his permission. The new title of the same article says, "Controversial coronavirus lab origin claims dismissed by experts." Now, experts could mean, well, who are these experts? I mean, is Sorensen not an expert? So essentially, Forbes created journalistic malpractice. Why on earth would a magazine like Forbes risk damaging its reputation over something as rather quotidian as a biological analysis of a virus? I mean, it's no skin off Forbes's nose if Sorensen is right.
I think I'm always interested in looking at the financial motives, which is why I mentioned the revolving door syndrome with the regulators. Now, there's another couple of things. It'd be interesting to get your take, Greg, on those. And that one is the advice by British doctors and by the British regulators, etc., and the mass media, to not use chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine, which apparently was very, very effective at treating, SARS-CoV-1 back in 2005, I believe that came out. But anyway, that was shown to be extremely good at treating that. And yet we were told in the UK, doctors were told, don't prescribe it for COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2. And they had even the World Health Organization changed the name of it away from taking SARS out of the name to maybe even, you know, to say to people, well, this has nothing to do with that stuff in the past that was cured by chloroquine. And I suppose the other thing is that there has been really very little or no messaging about using vitamin C, vitamin D, basically to boost the immune system, and zinc, which are known to help your own immune system to cope with anything. So the idea here really is that, you know, the virus is coming in your nose, starts to get a hold, and your body needs the various ammunition to fight any virus. And surely that is also going to be something that the government, you would hope. But the problem with these two, both chloroquine and vitamins, is they're not patented, and there's no one's going to make any money out of them, whereas vaccines are.
Yes, that's an interesting point. I have to say that I did not get into the hydroxychloroquine or the other remedies for my book, which was largely designed to show that this is not a natural virus. But I have read about this, and I do know that there have been patents taken out on everything to do with SARS-CoV-2 and any sort of SARS-related disease. Because it does look like a money grab by some people who are keen to make money off of the disease. Now, I say I didn't get into it, but there is evidence, there is undeniable evidence that patents have been taken out on this. There's patent U.S. number 7220852, and this is taken out by the Department of Health and Human Services Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They're taking out a patent on methods of using molecules to detect the SARS virus. I mean, there are patents out there. You can actually go out and research these yourself. There's one, just let me just check something I have here. Antiviral agents for the treatment, control, and prevention of infections by coronaviruses. And this is the patent taken out by Sequoia Pharmaceuticals, April 2003. So this goes back to the first SARS virus, of course. And this is U.S. patent number 715-1163. So these people, it is possible to argue that this virus is too lucrative to be killed so easily by rather mundane treatments like hydroxychloroquine or vitamin C or D. But as I say, I've not investigated this, and so I'm going to leave it up to experts who can speak more authoritatively than I can.
There is another side to, you know, your specific look at the pandemic. plandemic, whatever you want to call it, and that is the possible criminality involved here. Now, I mean, it may be that whoever has created this SARS-CoV-2 virus and then let it spread around the, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. One, it could be being released accidentally. The other one, potentially deliberate. But whatever, whoever mm-hmm. made it shouldn't have made it. And it would be interesting, wouldn't it, to find out if you can, if you think that that is feasible to actually track down an individual that made it. Because actually, quite a few people in China, I believe at least a couple of people involved in the original discovery of this have subsequently died.
I haven't heard about the deaths of the Chinese. I heard that Shizheng Li, who is the coronavirus expert at Wuhan laboratory, went missing for a while. I don't know if she is still missing or whether she has surfaced.
Well, yes, that's definitely, I mean, that sounds to me like a clue we should definitely be following up, Greg.
It should be, and I think that's an excellent idea for a follow-up. But I want to talk a little bit about criminality. I mean, as I said, my book is based upon one of the premises, and that is that SARS-CoV-2, however serious it may be, is a symptom of a larger problem, and that is gain-of-function research, which essentially is germ warfare by any other name. And Francis Boyle, who is an expert on germ warfare and someone who's very trustworthy, goes so far as to say that the people involved in creating this are guilty of a criminal act. I'm going to read you a short little blurb here. All these so-called scientists involved at the University of North Carolina and everyone who funded this project for SARS-CoV-2 knew that it was essentially existentially dangerous, and that includes NIAID, Dr. Anthony Fauci, National Institutes of Health, and the Dana-Harvard Cancer Institute at Harvard. One of the variants of criminal intent is the demonstration of grave indifference to human life, and that is the criminal intent necessary for homicide. So one could make the argument that those who concocted this virus in laboratory were showing conspicuous disregard for human life. And that would be an interesting...
Well, yeah, but they would say, wouldn't they, Greg? They would say, well, we're only following orders.
Yeah, the Nazis said the same thing. But that's not going to fly. The Nuremberg laws would prevent that. I mean, the United States, even though we can take issue with some of the history of World War II, the Nuremberg laws do state that following orders is not a defense. By the way, anybody who would like to get a copy of my book should go to the website turningthetidepublishing.com.
And just give us the title.
It's called SARS-CoV-2, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption.
And Greg, I think it'd be also interesting to hear your other books. Give us, you can give us those titles too, because you're obviously sitting there over in Vancouver, rather in the know.
Well, my first book was called "The Host and the Parasite: How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America," and this book grew out of the World Trade Center implosion. Now, like most people, I saw it on TV, and I was rather dumbstruck by what I saw. And initially, the book was going to be a biography of Osama bin Laden, because I was kind of getting sick and tired of the vilification of him by the mainstream media, who clearly had no idea who this man was or what he was doing. But the more I dug into it, and after going through two other disreputable publishers, I managed to come up with a new title and a new focus. And so rather than focus on bin Laden himself, I looked at the history of the United States through seven presidents, beginning with Harry Truman, going up to now, updated to include his Donaldness, to show that the United States has progressively lost its independence to the Israeli lobby through seven stages of what I call the Zionization of America. And now that we have, you know, Joe Biden in the presidency, we have Israel's natural governing party back in control of the United States. The book is quite long. It's 562 pages, took me 5 years to write, and I think it'll stand up for quite a few years, because the history that's in there is not going to change. The other book I wrote is called Exploding Middle East Myths, 15 Years of Fighting Zionist Propaganda. These latter two books are put out by a different imprint called Money Tree Publishing and can be found at moneytreepublishing.com. Exploding Middle East Myths is a collection of essays I wrote when I was a journalist here in Vancouver. They cover things like the Middle East history, censorship, language, the abuse of language, propaganda. And these are all kind of related thematically, because all of them have to do with the Zionist control of our mainstream media. I mean, it's not even possible to criticize somebody. One of our members of parliament, we ran the election we just had this year, mentioned something rather factual about the unseemly closeness between our then Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland and our buddy George Soros. And George Soros is the imminent squeeze behind a lot of left-wing activist groups. And she was called on the carpet for, among other things, anti-Semitism, because, of course, Soros is Jewish, and we didn't want to, you know, bring up some anti-Jewish propaganda, none of which was even remotely mentioned in her tweet, which caused this whole dust-up. So the Zionist lobby ensures that censorship takes place here. And the one thing I was thinking of getting into but didn't have the time was the fact that Pfizer has a very strong relationship with Israel. And Pfizer is one of the companies coming out with the vaccine, BNT162. Now, it's interesting that BNT161, its precursor, had severe side effects. And I'm just hoping that they managed to get rid of those side effects before they inflict it on the mass public.
Well, it looks like they're going to be inflicting it on the mass public here in Britain as of next week. And the British regulators have been the first to embrace this Pfizer vaccine. Talking in the pub this evening, because we are allowed back in the pubs in Tier 2 in Gloucestershire, where I am at the moment. One little tiny little speck of area which the pubs are open in most of the whole of the south of England. I don't know whether it's that there's a very strong conservative lobby in the Cotswolds or whether it's because Prince Charles lives here, although I don't think we see him down the pub very often. But anyhow, you know, that down there, they are saying, well, hang on, this is Dr. Mengele stuff, isn't it? This vaccine is Dr. Evil with his needle, and this is a German company.
Well, I think it's a little bit of prejudice to dump on Pfizer for being German. I mean, they can't help that. But I think it'd be more productive, rather than, you know, revert to stereotype, to look at the actual physical limitations of this vaccine, because it has not been tested properly. I mean, Pfizer was given, had applied for fast track approval in June of this year. Now, you got to figure, according to the official record, which is, of course, highly speculative, we first heard about the SARS-CoV-2 virus in December 2019. So you got to figure that 6 months after the discovery of a virus, or the alert to a virus, we have a vaccine. I mean, it just takes that short a time. I just find it a little implausible that we still do not have a HIV vaccine, yet we could come up with a SARS-CoV-2 vaccine in what is almost literally the blink of an eye.
Well, that's right. It's because these mRNA vaccines apparently come quicker to market, which is why the hedge funds are very, very in favor of shoveling enormous amounts of cash to people like Pfizer to do R&D. Doesn't mean to say they're safe. Now, look, most self-respecting journalists, Greg, don't ever pretend to have a crystal ball. But I'm just going to ask you finally where you think this is heading, because what's been happening with the COVID-19 really is global and it's unprecedented.
It is unprecedented. And unfortunately, everybody, whenever there's a disaster of whatever type, somebody makes profit off of it. It benefits somebody. I would like to say that the virus will run its course within a year, and that there will be none of these multiple hundreds or thousands of new cases cropping up from day to day. But I really don't know. I think to a large extent, this is going to be a status quo that we're going to have to live with for a while. But I'm concerned that for the health of humanity, that people are going to find themselves sicker because of this vaccine than healthier. I could be wrong. I could be dead wrong. And I will be the first to admit it. But in the absence of definitive safety studies and proper evaluations, I do not trust the people rushing to flog these mRNA vaccines. Having said that, I want to state that I fully support the mumps, measles, rubella, and other childhood vaccines that have kept us healthy for decades. And these have been proven to work. These are not the same as this radical vaccine, which is designed to create the very conditions that the virus also creates to stimulate the production of antibodies. Now, I don't want my body creating the same virus that's going to infect me. I just don't trust this approach.
It's quick to market.
Yeah, it's quick to get, because somebody's going to make a ton of money on this. This is why it's going to be rushed to market. AstraZeneca, which is out of Oxford, is in trouble because it found that it had too many side effects to its version, and the Americans are going to prevent it from distributing in the United States. However, AstraZeneca has approached the Canadian government for its vaccine, and I don't know whether the Canadian government is going to go ahead with it or not. But it worries me that there's this deterministic, almost knee-jerk reaction to follow it for its own sake. It's almost as if thought were taken out of the equation. Oh, it's a vaccine. We need a vaccine. Let's go get whatever we give us. We've lost our ability to take a step back and rationally understand precisely what it is going on. This, we're being stampeded into something that we don't understand. If it's safe, great. If it's not, we have a right to know about it. And nobody seems interested in taking precautions and doing things the right way. What does it benefit us for the Food and Drug Administration in the United States to pencil whip this through their regulatory process if it isn't going to work? How much ADE testing has been done? Clearly, this antibody-dependent enhancement does not occur in patients who have been vaccinated against bat coronaviruses. So here again is an evidence that this is not a bat coronavirus. This is something out of a laboratory, out of some Dr. Moreau type of unholy hybrid of two different things.
But you wouldn't say Dr. Mengele, no?
No, I don't want to go there. I find Nazi analogies to be trite and rather inflammatory.
Well, there was the human experimentation and guinea pigs.
I guess you could make that, but that never occurred to me. I mean, Mengele has such an odious reputation that any allusion to him is probably going to have more of an emotional impact than a rational one. So I tend to stay away from Nazi analogies, however logical some might find them.
Okay. Greg Felton, author of SARS-CoV-2, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Don't forget TurningTheTidePublishing.com. That's where you can get it. And it's being printed as we speak.